It's okay that actually we have just an incremental contribution.
Data Stories is brought to you by Qlik, who allows you to explore the hidden relationships within your data that lead to meaningful insights. Let your instincts lead the way to create personalized visualizations and dynamic dashboards with Qlik Sense, which you can download for free at qlik.de/datastories. That's qlik.de/datastories.
Hey everyone, welcome to a new episode of Data Stories. Hey Moritz.
Hey Enrico.
What's up?
Much yeah. Here. I'm in the final stretch of my US tour.
Yeah.
So I'm now in, I arrived in Boston finally, final station. I've been to Minneapolis, San Francisco, Vancouver, Information Plus conference, and now I'm at the Information Design Lab here in Boston.
Uh-huh.
And that's actually 2 points that connects me to our guest today, which is a, sort of a funny coincidence.
Yes, I'm very happy to have on the show Isabel Mireles. Hey, Isabel, how are you? Welcome on the show.
Hi, Enrico. Hi, Moritz. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a real pleasure.
Great to have you on. So, Isabel is a professor of design at the University of Toronto, and she is also the author of a very nice data visualization book called Design for Information. And she's also one of the organizers of the Information Plus conference that just happened, as Moritz said. So we want to talk about a little bit about the book, your work as a professor in this area, and Information Plus conference.
Great.
So, Isabel, can we start by giving a little bit of background about you, what you are doing, where you come from, and then we'll start talking about the book and the conference.
Okay, so basically, I have a background in architecture. I studied architecture as an undergrad, and then I moved from architecture into working in museums with architecture, and then finally in graphic design, and then eventually coming to the US to learn more about interaction and motion. And then it sort of combined my interests. I understood, you know, as working in editorial design, I knew about infographics, and we used to do infographics, and I knew about Malofiage, for example, for a very long time. And so when I came to the US and started eventually engaging into education, I kind of combined all those little bits of my previous sorts of all many different lives that I had into thinking more specifically about information design visualization. And so, and that's what I pretty much bring into both my teaching and my research, and a little bit of my design practice. Although I do still work mostly in my, I have another side of my brain that actually works with museums and interactive and more experimental interfaces, that it's for another podcast.
So your background originally is from architecture then. I think we had a few guests in the past with a similar background, at least one. I think Paolo as a Ciuccarelli also has a background in architecture. It's a very interesting. I think people that do visualization and have a background in architecture have a very kind of like recognizable style.
Yeah.
And way of approaching the problem.
Yeah, I actually worked as an I'm a licensed architect in Brazil, even though, you know, I would go to prison if I decide to go back into architecture because it's been many years. And my first master is in architecture. I actually did it at the Architecture Association School of Architecture in London. And so, yeah.
And what got you excited? Can you pinpoint when you got into information design and later data visualization? Like, what were your early inspirations?
Well, I moved from architecture into working in museums for different reasons, because my passion is in art. But, you know, so I started working to designing exhibitions. I actually designed some furniture for a museum. But I also chaired the department of that related to everything that had to do with the public. And so I was responsible for art education for all the programs in this very important museum in São Paulo, that is the most well-known museum in South America for European art, called the Museu de Arte de São Paulo, in São Paulo, where I'm originally from. And the museum decided to do a magazine. And I was the person responsible for being the liaison between the whole team that was hired to be in doing this magazine. So the people designing the magazine were the same team that designed the Brazilian issue of Vogue magazine in Brazil. And so I remember going to their office and say, wow, people do this for a living? I was really, you know, I'd never really thought about graphic design. And so eventually I decided to move away again a second time in life, right, from, you know, into editorial design. So as a graphic designer, I only worked in editorial design. I never worked in any other area. And as in editorial design, as you know, from newspapers or magazines, we're very much into information. So our mandate is actually designing information and communicating information in ways that make sense. And so, that's what perhaps is the link there that actually brought me to information design in the more traditional way within the design community. And later, now that we have so much more access to data, into other more expanded ways of visualizing information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so interesting, because a lot of the biographies leading to data visualization only make sense once you end up in data visualization, because then, you know, you need all this knowledge, like on design and structures and data and code and whatever. But forward looking, it can be a confusing travel sometimes.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, eventually what is interesting is it's not going to happen so much in the present and future generations of the young people who are entering the space right now of visualization of data. But for us, who started earlier, or for myself, that eventually at least, it's actually, we are coming from different fields, and I think it's not uncommon. I mean, I hear most of your speakers actually who have been in the field for a while. We all bring this diversity of knowledge into our commonalities, our challenges of making it effective or, you know, so if and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah. I think that's what makes this field so interesting and at the same time so confusing sometimes, I guess. But I think if you look at the list of people that we had on the show so far, they have so many different kind of backgrounds. It's fascinating in a way. We could actually try to make a catalog of what kind of background people that have been on the show have. It's very, very diverse. Isabel, you made me think about the fact that I never saw data visualization inspired furniture. That's an interesting idea. Somebody should do it.
It is true, because we've seen jewelry, we've seen clothing, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I've never seen furniture.
Or buildings.
I've seen a few nice tables.
Tables? So. Oh, you've seen tables?
Oh, there you go.
So, Isabel, let's talk a little bit about your book. So the book is called Design for Information. And if you're listening to this and you don't know the book yet, you can Google it or go to Amazon or related websites and find it. It's a really beautiful book. I remember receiving this book and thinking, just flipping through the pages, it's like, oh my God, it's beautiful, right? But at the same time, it's not only a coffee table book. It's not only images. It's more like a proper textbook. And I think this is what makes this book so interesting. When you flip through the pages, there are lots of nice images. It's beautiful. It's interesting, but there is a lot of science and design and guidelines and background and even the way it's organized. It's very interesting. So how did you get started with the book? Why did you decide to create a book in the first place?
Well, I actually had never thought of writing a book. I was approached by the publishers, Rockford Publishers, who are a well-known textbook, art and design textbook publisher in the U.S., and so someone gave my name as a potential person who could write an introduction in the area. So my initial reaction was, no, I've never written a book. I don't have a PhD. I was not trained to write.
And yeah, it's so scary. Writing a book is one of the scariest things ever.
Yeah, and so, and then my partner Ron, he said, oh no, you complain, you don't have books, so you cannot say no. You go ahead and you write the book. So I took the challenge and decided to write the book. And so the idea was eventually, so it is a textbook, as you rightly put. And I really wrote with that in mind. And because I actually learned, as we, many of us, and we, that's what the beauty of learning in life is, that we keep learning life, right? And so I, for me, I used the way I learn into how I wrote it. And so, because most of the issues that I learned, including graphic design and many other things in information design and visualization, I actually, the way I learn is actually context-based. And so that's how I structure the book. So I thought, rather than doing the traditional way of, okay, a color on perception, a chapter on perception, a chapter on color, a chapter on algorithms, a chapter on design, which there is nothing wrong about it, right? But I decided to actually do it the way I learned and the way I taught. That is more kind of, especially when you teach to designers, I tend to read a lot of science and that I need to digest in order to convey to my students that that is important, that they should know. So that's more or less how I did it. And that's why there is a little bit of perception, cognition, and history, and theory, and tips, practical tips, including every single of the chapters. And of course, there are lots of things that are not there. So I don't go much into the technicalities of algorithms or computational methods, which is also not my strength to start with. But I eventually opened some doors in terms of giving references where people could eventually find those references.
So one thing I was wondering, does the organization of the book or even the content come from the course that you teach, or the course came later? Which one is like a chicken and egg kind of problem?
No, I started teaching in 2003. So I was first hired as a professor in 2003 at Northeastern University. And that was, they took a big bet on me because it was my first time teaching by myself in a class, and it was a tenure track position. Uh-huh. So I was very happy with that. And so I was hired basically to teach two courses, one in motion graphics, which is another area that I've been writing. I created a theory, written about it, and information design. And so that's what I've been mostly teaching since 2003. And I structured the course very differently. I guess when I was writing the book, I thought it should be way more encompassing than what my course is, because I've been teaching only courses that are introductory courses. So at Northeastern University, that was the only time I only had one class. And so I had to actually capture the imagination of my students in this one course so that they could actually be willing to keep learning and working in the field. So it is not as comprehensive as the book is, but I felt that the book, since it is an introduction, it should touch on all these different data structures. Yep. And so that's, there is a big difference, I actually, in terms of what the course is about and what the book end up mm-hmm. being.
That's one of the things that I like the most about the book. I think you organize the chapters around specific data structures. So I have in front of me, so I'm reading. So you have trees, networks, timelines and flows, maps, structures, and then textual structures. And when you think about it, I may be mistaken, but I don't think that any of the previous books were organized around these structures. And I think it's a nice way of thinking about the data visualization design space, right? Because most of the times, the kind of problem you are confronted with is, oh, I have this data set and there is kind of like this kind of information structure. So now what is the vocabulary, right, that I have in front of me that I can use in order to kind of like match my problem with existing visualization techniques? And at least that's the way I try to teach it in class, at least partially. And I find it very fruitful. And so how did you decide to organize the book around these structures and not in a different way?
Yeah, again, it was thinking about case studies and about thinking about the ways we represent data. So even though, for example, if we look right at the different chapters, eventually we're going to see, for example, election data, right? That actually you would find it in the spatial structure, as in forms of different maps, for example, or in the spatial temporal, and as well as in the textual, for example, right? And so for me, it was more about helping the reader or the practitioner and the student out there understanding a little bit of the histories and the theories, but also in the different questions that one should be asking oneself when we go into visualizing data. So for me, it was it created more opportunities for expanding on certain issues rather than partitioning the other way around. I don't know if I'm being clear. I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. Because I have to say that another thing I really like is that you organize information around this. You organize the content around information structures, right? Give lots of examples, kind of like try to lay out the design space. And then only then you provide some background theory, right? Which is, I have to say, in retrospect, it's very powerful, right? That's not the way I used to teach these kind of things, right? Mm. I think the more traditional way is like, I'll give you all the theory and then we'll do the practice, right? Which doesn't, I have to say, after teaching for a few years, it doesn't work very well, right? And whereas this book is more about, oh, I'll show you what, so this is the information structure that we have. These are some solutions, right? Visualization patterns or techniques. But here, now I'll give you a little bit of theory and now you can think a little bit more broadly, right? How it can become more generative from your side. Does it make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
I hope I'm not overreading your intents.
I think absolutely. It's like, you know, I think one of the important things as an educator is helping the students connect the dots, right? And so what I felt is like when I separate too much into theory or, you know, including color theory or design theory, you know, it's eventually when the students start designing, they actually are unable to connect the theories that they learned into the design opportunities and the design solutions that they are trying to develop. And so if you actually, rather than separating and you integrate, okay, so now in this particular case, let's imagine if you're dealing with color, so why not think about all the different issues that we have in terms of illusions or color blindness or other perceptual issues, right? So rather than talking it in a separate way, let's incorporate into the dialogue of the making and within the context that we are discussing, right? Because there's so much to learn, right? That is actually impossible to tackle all these issues in depth. But if we study within the case studies, it's actually easier to actually go a little bit or show the relevance of why we should be studying, you know, perception and cognition, because they are actually essential to how we design, because we are designing for humans, right? It's vision, right?
In my experience, it's also a difference between scientific academia and design, teaching design, or how art and design schools operate. And as Enrico said quite rightly, it's in scientific academia, it's more like first you learn all the theory for a few years before you have the license to actually produce something, right? And in design, it's often more like, yeah, here's five projects that have some similarities. Let's make one like those, right? Or let's do something along these lines. And I think, yeah, that can sometimes also lead to problems that you don't know. Oh, there's been hundreds of years of history around this topic. Whoops. but this mixture can be super powerful. Like first guiding people with concrete examples into a field and then expand and give them the tools to actually do something substantial. Yeah.
And I think you touched it on a part that I think is essential. I mean, I try to include a lot of historical examples in the book. I had many more that I was unable to include for copyright issues and for the lack of resources to purchase those images. But I think I always try to bring the history, because we tend to forget. We tend to think that, okay, we're living this unusual situation that we have all this data. But people have in the past, they have faced similar challenges. And that's why eventually they came with some solutions, including Playfair, right? And so so having that also kind of, it brings some humility to who we are and where we are in our position and our contribution, that actually there are people who have faced similar challenges. And it's okay that actually we have just an incremental contribution. We don't need to have, you know, huge contributions, because it's almost impossible in some areas, right? And so to show that the space of contribution has different granularities, from incremental to actually larger representation contributions.
So, Isabel, before we move on to, we also want to talk about this conference that just happened. Before we move on to that, just wanted to ask you, so what's coming up next? Do you have any other project in terms of publishing, or I don't know, just curious about it?
Yeah, so I moved to Canada about a year and a half ago to teach at OCAD University, which is basically a university of art and design. It is the oldest art and design college in Canada. It's almost 150 years old and recently became a university. So now one of the reasons that they were interested is actually that I actually have been largely involved with research in collaboration with different areas. And so I have, I'm working on few research projects in addition to teaching. And so I have one grant that I received from AAGA, which is the American Association for the Graphic Designers in the US. And I'm actually trying to create a framework for thinking about interactive information visualizations from the design perspective, similar to what I did with the book. But now what I proposed was to discuss 10 projects in this area. So I'm trying to separate presentation from representation and to discuss and create a framework for thinking about those issues. In a similar way that I did with the book, but it's way more complex. And so I don't know how successful I'm going to be, but I'm looking forward to finalizing this in the next year. And so I spent the past year and a half actually working many hours into putting this conference together. And now I will be continue to work so that we can make it happen again, because I think that there is an interesting momentum in terms of bringing all these communities together. And there's a lot of work. I actually you know, together with my collaborator, we wrote a grant. We got a social science and humanities grant from Canada to help make this conference possible. So it was a research project in a way of actually communicating the importance of making this happen. And I'm also part of a very large grant on transportation issues here in Toronto, which is a little bit outside of my own expertise of what I do in visualization, but it's actually together with a very large group of people at the University of Toronto in Transportation Department, as well as Waterloo University, and with the Visual Analytics Lab directed by Sarah Diamond here at OCAD University. Yeah, and I'm working on a few other smaller grants and writing a proposal right now. And so something for the future. Yeah. And I have been very closely involved just to finalize with the network science community. And so for 6 years now, we've been creating this symposium on arts, humanities, and complex networks that actually runs parallel to NetSci, to Network Science main conference, and together with Maximilian Stich and Roger Molina, both from UT mm-hmm. Dallas.
Wow, so you have a couple of things going on, huh?
Yeah.
Not bad.
This is a good time to take a little break and talk about our sponsor this week, Qlik, who allows you to explore the hidden relationships within your data that lead to meaningful insights. Let your instincts lead the way to create personalized visualizations and dynamic dashboards with Qlik Sense, which you can download for free at qlik.de/datastories. So, are you into Formula One? It's a real sport for data nerds and an excellent opportunity to compare statistics. Qlik has a really interesting app on their website that allows you to compare stats for all the drivers and constructors over the past few years. You can see how the overall speeds have developed, but also which country, for instance, has the most wins in terms of drivers or constructors and so on. They even have a nice lap-by-lap replay of each race in the form of an animated bump chart, so you can always see how the ranking within the race has developed, which I really enjoyed. It provides this neat summary of how a race went down and when the deciding phase was in each race. So it's a really good visualization. Check it out for yourself on the Qlik website. The link is in the show notes. And make sure to try out Qlik Sense for free at qlik.de/datastories. That's qlik.de/datastories. And now back to the show.
Shall we talk about the conference? I was there too, so I can comment as well. So that's good.
Yeah, that is fantastic.
Yeah, but first you, like, what is Information Plus about? How did it start? How did you get this together? And how do you think it turned out in its first instantiation?
Yeah, so because I collaborate with so many people, right? I'm almost like the most insider outsider, or the most outsider insider of many communities, and including at Northeastern, I used to be part of the Center for Digital Humanities, which is called the Text and Maps at NU. And so basically, I always wanted to actually put a lot of people talking together. So actually 3 years ago or 4 years ago, together with Mariah Mayer and Ben from University of Utah and Bang Wong from the Broad Institute at MIT and Harvard, we wrote this white paper on the challenges of actually interdisciplinarity within the information visualization community, from literacy to actually developing projects together. And so in a way, the idea of the conference was pretty much what we said in the first day. It was related to a dream of actually, can we bring all these communities together to discuss issues, in more particularly about the design aspects of information visualization? Because I think there are many incredible venues out there that actually discuss other aspects of information visualization, such as the V's series of conferences there that actually discuss the more computational aspects of what is done in visual analytics, in data visualization, and so forth, as well as the Network Science has all the venues about talking about network problems and graphs problems. And the graphic design community has all these different conferences to discuss very little about information design, I should say. And so my dream was, can we come together and discuss and present what we've been doing so that we can share and even start collaborating more? And so that was more or less the whole idea of creating this conference. So together with my collaborator, Catherine Gilson from Emily Carr, we've been working pretty much a year and a half into putting this conference together. And because I was in transition from Northeastern to OCAD University, rather than actually hosting it at OCAD, we thought of starting it at Emily Carr. But our idea is actually that it could be something biennial, so every other year that we could have this conference together.
Yeah. And so it was both a conference, but also a workshop and an exhibition. So it's like a full package of activities. And can you give us a broad overview of the topics? So because I think that the way you put this together was quite nice, in a sense that a lot of different avenues or different fields of activity in database were covered quite well, right?
Yeah. So basically, it was like the idea was that we would have all these three events that would be happening at once. So it's a information plus umbrella of events that I had the exhibition that would run for 1 month at the gallery at Emily Carr. So it was a call for submissions for the exhibition. And it was mostly co-created by Catherine Gillison and Gillian Russell, who is a PhD candidate at the Royal College of Art in London. So we hired her as a research assistant through our grant that was successful. And then there was the conference, which was this two-day, one-track conference. So it was very big for us that the conference would be a one-track, so it was about building community. And so the conference, being an educator and having gone through the challenges of getting tenure, we understand that it was important for the submissions that it was peer reviewed. So we had this incredible program committee coming from very diverse places, from computer science, from design, from humanities, from the sciences, that actually every single submission to the conference was received a three independent review that was peer reviewed. So we received 111 submissions to the conference, and it was a 22% acceptance rate for the papers, for the 20-minute paper, and a 44 for the 5-minute. So we had two tracks. So it was 20-minute presentations and 5-minute talks. And we actually wanted it to be diverse, including not only diversity of academic fields, but also diversity between practitioners and academics. And so we were pretty much actually able to accomplish that. And we had actually 60% of speakers coming from academia and 40% coming from industry. And we also had a beautiful diversity in terms of gender. So 45% of women and 55% of men.
That's really good. Yeah.
But to finish that. And so the other idea was the workshop, right? So the idea of the workshop, just to finalize that, sorry for a long answer, was I always go to conference and I think that, you know, there's always this idea of the workshop being the first thing and then comes the conference. And I always feel a little bit that when I go to a conference, I get supercharged and I heard all these incredible things. I want to go ahead and start designing, creating, and looking for new data. And, you know, there is that kind of energy that drives me out of listening to incredible talks. And so I thought of actually reversing the workshop. So rather than having the workshop at the beginning, why not use that whole energy that people get, right? So that the workshop comes last. So rather than actually being a skill building idea of workshop, oh, now we are going to learn about E3 or about whatever, is actually, can we just have a hands-on trying to more of a design tank idea of developing solutions based on a lot of things that we've heard from the talks. So those are the three main events. And now we will be putting hopefully everything available online.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting because also the selection process, so in design often it's invitation only. So somebody makes a program for a conference and just invites their favorite people. In academia, you often have to hand in first a full paper, so lots of work, and then you get rejected or not. So that's obviously not working for people who have better things to do, like me. So I found this very interesting, like how you bridge these walls also in the organization. One thing I realized, so I really liked there are lots of good scientists, lots of practical people. There was also Scott Murray from O'Reilly who's teaching. So he talked about online teaching. Data journalists, designers, but we didn't have any artists. That's also something I remarked, right? So that's maybe an idea for next time. And I think artists wouldn't submit a paper for a talk to be accepted. So maybe we find new avenues. We need to find new avenues for artists to get into this.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think, in part what we really wanted to bridge those communities, including the journalism community. That is actually, for me, it was my entry point in my graphic design life. So I find it a very close proximity to graphic design traditionally, because a lot of people leave graphic design and go into working editorial design. And so basically, I agree that in order, to set up the tone of any conference that you ask for submissions, what helps is the keynotes and the invited speakers. Mm-hmm. So pretty much when we invited Tamara Munzner and Colin Ware, who were our two keynotes to the conference, we did it actually more than a year ago. It was actually the end of May 2015. We were inviting them to be our keynotes so that we could actually announce them as we were announcing the conference so that people could engage. And we did the same with some of our first, we had four invited speakers, two of which we were able to engage from the very beginning. And those were Chad Skelton, who is from Vancouver and used to be at the Vancouver Sun, and from that time on had recently transitioned into consulting and teaching, but he's actually a data journalist. And Caterina Di Nazio, who is actually from the communication side and from the coding kind of, she actually also an artist in a way, right? It's like engaging to code, but mostly from the civic engagement and the social engagement of the data part. And so with that, the invited speakers are always the ones that actually kind of help into what you were saying, Moritz, of actually setting the tone. And I definitely think that for next one, we should have an artist among those, because that would help engage another set of community and also a different kind of dialogue.
Yeah, but it was a great event, and there's a few things I really learned. I also think Catherine's talk was amazing, so we should definitely try and get her on at some point. And it was also interesting to hear Gregor Eisch close with his very realistic view on what data visualization development means in this world of mobile devices and how difficult it has become to do really complex stuff in, let's say, real settings. So it was it's sort of enlightening too. Yeah, and for me personally, it was nice because I met all my friends from Potsdam. So there were like, I think, nine German speakers. So that was a funny.
Yeah, I had to say that I was when I put the call together and I emailed many people that I've been in touch throughout the years, including you, Moritz, and that actually I sent the email, okay, this is a new conference, please help us spread the word or engage with us in terms of submitting your work and for presentation. And pretty much we are able to have you presenting, Moritz, exactly through that. So I'm very grateful that you did that. And but I have to give a big Thank you to two Potsdam colleagues from yours, from that actually Marian Dorg and Till Nagel, who actually from the very beginning when they received my email and started tweeting about, and that maybe that was something that they had recently discussed at VIS in 2015 about how to bring more design discussion within this larger, broader data visualization discussion. And they, it was incredible because of their visibility and their engagement with all the different communities, how much we received back that actually people started engaging, including, you know, they helped me immensely with putting together the program committee. You know, there were these people on the background that were not visible, but I'm very grateful for their engagement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's nice because I think you tapped into something that many people thought, oh, there should be a conference around that. But, you know, nobody actually stepped up and actually did it. And now that you did that with your colleagues, I think everybody was just happy that it finally happened. Right?
Yeah, so, yeah, I agree.
That's another good sign, I think, that, you know, everybody's up for that and really interested in connecting these worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was actually pretty incredible how, you know, the engagement, we really didn't think that we would have as many submissions as we received and so diverse. And it was, at one point, we were even trying to think, should this be a two-track conference? Because there were incredible papers that we had to, not that we were unable to accept. And it was such a pity. It is one of the worst things. It's actually because, you know, papers that I think would have been really amazing. But we really thought, okay, this is a first conference. So we should keep it small. We should build a community here and then move on, right? And so maybe in the next one, those people would still engage with the new organization into submitting and that was a pity. And even I'm still debating whether we can even engage with publication and invite back some of those people that we had not to refuse, right, for presentation, but whether it would be included in a publication effort, right, that actually saying, okay, this is the scope that actually it is much larger than actually we end up presenting.
Yeah, Isabel, I have to say, I mean, even if I wasn't there, I've been following through the Twitter feeds, and it's been really exciting just seeing what happened there through the tweets. And I am myself a big, big fan of trying to integrate academics and practitioners. That's one of the main reasons why actually I've been doing this show and other things myself, right? And I have to say one thing that is fascinating for me is to see that, I am of course much more familiar with the academic community, and I love to see how academics, when they have an opportunity to talk in a more relaxed environment, they tend to be freer to just put some ideas out, right? Because I think it's an interesting trade-off and problem there that in conferences like the IEEE VIS, that is highly academic, everyone is in a way super scared that whatever you say is judged analytically, right? And you have a kind of reputation to defend and all the rest, right? And whereas in environments that are a little bit more relaxed, but still rigorous, then you are free to express yourself, right? And I think that's a very, very nice aspect of the conference that you created. And related to that, conversely, I'm always fascinated by the fact that there are some practitioners that cite some academic work in their presentations. So this is really happening. I've been through the tweets, I've been seeing both things, and that's amazing. It is happening, and it's fantastic, right? I don't know. I can remember. I think Gregor, so Moritz, you mentioned Gregor, I think, in his presentation, if I'm not mistaken, he's been mentioning the Schneiderman's mantra, right?
Yeah, he made the mobile version of the mantra. Yeah,
the mobile mantra, right? I don't remember exactly how it was, but it's interesting, right? And you, in your presentation, Moritz, you've been talking about Tamara's design studies model. Yeah. I don't remember how exactly it's called.
Yeah, we invented Sally the snail.
A snail on top of it, right? So this is happening. And yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that, you know, there is a lot of talk nowadays in academia, at least in North America, that I'm more familiar with, about translational research, right? And I think that's exactly it, right? So how can we actually make the research that we do in academia transferable, right, and meaningful to the society as well as to the practitioners? Because some areas like design, you know, a lot of people go into working in the industry, and so how can they actually keep that dialogue and keep actually thinking theoretically, or keep pushing what they are doing in relevant ways, not only in their own, the business where they are practicing, but also in terms of this dialogue of thinking theoretically and actually pushing the way they are doing. And that's why I think we saw, you know, Lena from ProPublica, Lena Gruger, right, or Lisa Rost and Gregor and all these data journalists actually bringing theories into how they were discussing their practice. And even Chad Scaddon, I thought it was actually quite nice what he said, is how can we bring the thinking of data, of the practitioner, of data journalist, into the thinking and of the data visualization, data visualizer. And so it's how can we cross-pollinate from practice to theory and back and forth.
Yeah. So, Moritz or Isabel, do you have any highlights or anything you want to talk about?
I mean, I wish there was a separate episode on that topic. Like, you know, like a 1-hour summary. That would be amazing. So maybe we should make that happen.
We should make
that
happen.
I think we should look into it. Yeah. And otherwise, I think we might just link a few talks from the post. There should be video recordings. And yeah, but I mean, all of them have been great in a way. So it will be hard to make a selection, I think.
Yeah, I would be very happy to, you know, we are uploading the talks, but also would be happy to work with you, Moritz and Enrico, to actually kind of summarize what happened and create some highlights. They were really, it was a very dense 2 days with I think 17 talks in each day. So it was like really a lot of talks that would be hard to highlight, and each one brings a different topic. So even though when we created the schedule, we tried to organize under topics, there were actually cross connections. So one of the things that we tried to do, that was another dream of mine, is when I go to conference, especially very dense ones, I want to get to the end of the day and say, can anyone help me summarize what happened here? Were there any connections? Can anyone remember me? Because I heard so many things and I sort of forget things on the way. So we tried to create this summary kind of 20-minute breaks at the very end of the conference, where each one of the chairs kind of summarize and try to create connections. So we can actually try to do that, a new thing here, that we can create connecting the dots of the conference by those snippets. I don't know.
So you will be publishing the recorded videos on the web?
Yes, we will be uploading the videos. So we hired a team at Emily Carr that did the recordings, and they are going to be putting all these together. And once I receive that, I'll be uploading to the website. And I have to actually upload the PDF of the guidebook as well. And right now we are actually going to contact all the speakers, including the practitioners, into engaging into writing short and longer papers for publication in the Information Design Journal. So the Information Design Journal is traditionally a very long standing journal in information design for designers. But because design is a professional practice, so there is traditionally papers written by practitioners, which are not academic papers. And that was why we thought of that would be a good venue. So that would also be part of this effort. So I will be engaging with everyone who spoke about that.
So do you know already if the conference is happening again in 2 years or?
Yeah, so basically, you know, so when asked that, I said, no, I don't think it's a conference that should happen every year because it takes a lot of effort to put everyone into the room coming from all different areas of academia as well as from industry. And we don't want to disperse that. We want to create that energy that everyone wants to be there. And I think in order for that to happen, you know what, a biennial frequency is a good idea. So because there were so many people from Potsdam, we are trying to convince our Potsdam colleagues to
it's only
actually...
Fair. It's only fair.
Right, Moritz? Yeah, and yeah. So to actually have it in Germany. So, you know, IEEE VIS in 2018 will be in Germany, in Berlin, so that would be something that eventually could either be co-located or, you know, so we're starting to investigate that possibility.
That sounds like
fantastic.
A really good plan. I approve.
Okay, Isabel, well, thanks a lot for coming on the show and to talk about the book and the InfoPlus conference. These are amazing initiatives. Thanks so much.
I thank you, Enrico and Moritz. It was a real pleasure to be here with you. And again, thank you for the opportunity you gave me to talk about all these issues, including Information Plus, which I hope will continue.
We hope so too.
We hope so too.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah.
Thanks, Isabel.
Bye, Isabel. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to Data Stories again. Before you leave, we have a request. If you can spend a couple of minutes rating us on iTunes, that would be extremely helpful for the show.
And here's also some information on the many ways you can get news directly from us. We're of course on Twitter at twitter.com/datastories. We have a Facebook page at facebook.com/datastoriespodcast, all in one word. And we also have an email newsletter. So if you want to get news directly into your inbox and be notified whenever we publish an episode, you can go to our homepage, datastory.es, and look for the link that you find on the bottom in the footer.
So one last thing that we want to tell you is that we love to get in touch with our listeners, especially if you want to suggest a way to improve the show or amazing people you want us to invite or even projects you want us to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. So don't hesitate to get in touch with us. It's always a great thing for us. And that's all for now. See you next time. And thanks for listening to Data Stories.
Data Stories is brought to you by Qlik, who allows you to explore the hidden relationships within your data that lead to meaningful insights. Let your instincts lead the way to create personalized visualizations and dynamic dashboards with Qlik Sense, which you can download for free at www.qlik.de/datastories.